Disc 15.
In mid-July, Al Gore and I held an event at the National Academy of Sciences to highlight our administration's efforts to avoid computer meltdowns at the dawn of the new millennium. There was widespread concern that many computer systems would not make the change to the year 2000, which would cause havoc in the economy and disrupt the affairs of millions of Americans. We organized an exhaustive effort led by John Koskinen to make sure all government systems were ready for the new millennium and to help the private sector make the adjustment. We wouldn't know for sure whether we had been successful until the date arrived. On the 16th, I signed another of my priorities into law, the Child Support Performance and Incentive Act. We had already increased collection 68% since 1992. 1.4 million more families were now receiving child support. This bill penalized states that did not automate their child support files and gave financial rewards to those that were successful in meeting performance goals. Around this time, I announced the purchase of 80 billion bushels of wheat for distribution to poor nations with food shortages. Grain prices were down, and the purchase would both meet a humanitarian need and raise the price of wheat as much as 13 cents a bushel for hard-pressed farmers. Because a severe heat wave was destroying crops in parts of the country, I also asked Congress to pass an emergency farm aid package. Toward the end of the month, Mike McCurry announced that he would resign as White House press secretary in the fall, and I named his deputy, Joe Lockhart, who had served as press secretary for my reelection campaign, to succeed him. McCurry had done a fine job in a demanding position, answering tough questions, explaining the administration's policy with clarity and a quick wit, and working long hours with around-the-clock availability. He wanted to see his kids grow up. I liked Joe Lockhart a lot, and the press seemed to like him, too. Besides, he liked to play cards with me. We would have a smooth transition. In July, as I continued to push my agenda at home, Dick Holbrooke flew to Belgrade to see Milosevic in an attempt to resolve the Kosovo crisis. Prime Minister Hashimoto resigned after election losses in Japan. Nelson Mandela got married to Graça Machel, the lovely widow of a former president of Mozambique and a leading figure in the struggle to stop the use of children in Africa's wars. And Ken Starr continued to build his case against me. He insisted on taking the testimony of several of my Secret Service agents, including Larry Cockle, the head of my detail. The Secret Service had resisted this, and former President Bush had written two letters opposing it. Except when the president is on the residence floor of the White House, the Secret Service is always with him or just outside the door of whatever room he is in. Presidents depend on the Secret Service to protect them and to protect their confidences. The agents overhear all kinds of conversations involving national security, domestic policy, political conflicts, and personal struggles. Their dedication, professionalism, and discretion had served presidents of both parties and the nation well. Now Starr was willing to put all that at risk to investigate not espionage or Watergate-like abuses of the FBI or Iran-Contra-like willful defiance of the law, but whether I had given false answers and encouraged Monica Lewinsky to do the same in response to questions asked in bad faith in a case that had been thrown out of court because it had no merit in the first place. By the end of the month, Starr had granted Monica Lewinsky immunity from prosecution in return for her testimony before the grand jury and had subpoenaed me to testify as well. On the 29th, I agreed to testify voluntarily, and the subpoena was withdrawn. I can't say I was looking forward to it. Early in August, I met with 10 Indian tribal leaders in Washington to announce a comprehensive effort to increase educational, health care, and economic opportunities for Native Americans. My assistant for intergovernmental affairs, Mickey Ibarra, and Lynn Cutler, my liaison to the tribes, had worked hard on the initiative, and it was sorely needed. Although the United States was enjoying its lowest unemployment rate in 28 years, the lowest crime rate in 25 years, and the smallest percentage of our citizens on welfare in 29 years, Native American communities that had not grown wealthy from gambling operations were still in bad shape. Fewer than 10% of Native Americans went to college. They were three times more likely to suffer from diabetes as white Americans, and they still had the lowest per capita income of any American ethnic group. Some of the tribal communities had unemployment rates in excess of 50%. The leaders were encouraged by the new steps we were taking, and after the meeting, I had some hope that we could help them. The next day, the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya were hit by bombs that exploded within 5 minutes of each other, killing 257 people, including 12 Americans, and injuring 5,000 others. The initial evidence indicated that Osama bin Laden's network, which became known as Al-Qaeda, had launched the attacks. In late February, bin Laden had issued a fatwa calling for attacks on American military and civilian targets anywhere in the world. In May, he had said his supporters would hit U.S. targets in the Gulf and talked about bringing the war home to America. In June, in an interview with an American journalist, he had threatened to bring down U.S. military aircraft with anti-aircraft missiles. By this time, we had been following bin Laden for years. Early in my first term, Tony Lake and Dick Clark had pressed the CIA for more information about the wealthy Saudi, who had been expelled from his own country in 1991, had lost his citizenship in 1994, and had taken up residence in Sudan. At first, bin Laden seemed to be a financier of terrorist operations, but over time we would learn that he was the head of a highly sophisticated terrorist organization with access to large sums of money beyond his own fortune, and with operatives in several countries, including Chechnya, Bosnia, and the Philippines. In 1995, after the war in Bosnia, we had thwarted Mujahideen attempts to take over there, and in cooperation with local officials, had also stopped a plot to blow up a dozen planes flying out of the Philippines to the West Coast. But bin Laden's transnational network continued to grow. In January 1996, the CIA had established a station focused exclusively on bin Laden and his network within its counterterrorism center, and shortly thereafter we began to urge Sudan to expel bin Laden. Sudan was then a virtual safe haven for terrorists, including the Egyptians who had tried to kill President Mubarak the previous June, and who had succeeded in assassinating his predecessor, Anwar Sadat. The nation's leader, Hassan al-Turabi, shared bin Laden's radical views, and the two of them were involved in a whole host of business ventures, running the gamut from legitimate operations to weapons manufacturing and support for terrorists. As we pressed Turabi to expel bin Laden, we asked Saudi Arabia to take him. The Saudis didn't want him back, but bin Laden finally left Sudan in mid-1996, apparently on good terms with Turabi. He moved to Afghanistan, where he found a warm welcome with Mullah Omar, leader of the Taliban, a militant Sunni sect that was bent on establishing a radical Muslim theocracy in Afghanistan. In September 1996, the Taliban captured Kabul and started seizing other areas of the country. By the end of the year, the CIA's bin Laden unit had developed significant information on him and his infrastructure. Almost a year later, Kenyan authorities arrested a man they believed was involved in a terrorist plot against the U.S. Embassy there. In the week after the bombings, I kept up my regular schedule, traveling to Kentucky, Illinois, and California to promote the Patients' Bill of Rights and our Clean Water Initiative, and to help Democrats up for election in those states. Beyond the public events, I spent most of my time with our national security team discussing how we were going to respond to the African attacks. On August 13th, there was a memorial service at Andrews Air Force Base for 10 of the 12 American victims. The people bin Laden believed deserved to die just because they were Americans included a career diplomat I had met twice and his son, a woman who had just spent her vacation caring for her aged parents, an Indian-born Foreign Service officer who had traveled the world working for her adopted country. An epidemiologist working to save African children from disease and death. A mother of three small children. A proud new grandmother. An accomplished jazz musician with a day job in the Foreign Service. An embassy administrator who had married a Kenyan. And three sergeants, one each in the Army, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps. By all accounts, bin Laden was poisoned by the conviction that he was in possession of the absolute truth and therefore free to play God by killing innocent people. Since we had been going after his organization for several years, I had known for some time that he was a formidable adversary. After the African slaughter, I became intently focused on capturing or killing him and with destroying Al-Qaeda. 1 week after the embassy bombings and after videotaping an address to the people of Kenya and Tanzania, whose losses were far greater than ours, I met with the national security principals. The CIA and FBI both confirmed that Al-Qaeda was responsible and reported that some of the perpetrators had already been arrested. I had also received an intelligence report that Al-Qaeda had plans to attack yet another embassy in Tirana, Albania, and that our enemies thought America was vulnerable because we would be distracted by the controversy over my personal behavior. We closed the Albanian embassy, sent in heavily armed Marines to guard it, and began working with local authorities to break up the Al-Qaeda cell there. But we still had other embassies in countries with Al-Qaeda operations. The CIA also had intelligence that bin Laden and his top staff were planning a meeting at one of his camps in Afghanistan on August 20th to assess the impact of their attacks and plan their next operations. The meeting would provide an opportunity to retaliate and perhaps wipe out much of the Al-Qaeda leadership. I asked Sandy Berger to manage the process leading up to a military response. We had to pick targets, move the necessary military assets into place, and figure out how to handle Pakistan. If we launched airstrikes, our planes would pass over Pakistan's airspace. Although we were trying to work with Pakistan to defuse tensions on the Indian subcontinent, and our two nations had been allies during the Cold War, Pakistan supported the Taliban and, by extension, Al-Qaeda. The Pakistani intelligence service used some of the same camps that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did to train the Taliban and insurgents who fought in Kashmir. If Pakistan found out about our planned attacks in advance, it was likely that Pakistani intelligence would warn the Taliban or even Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott, who was working to minimize the chances of military conflict on the Indian subcontinent, was afraid that if we didn't tell the Pakistanis, they might assume the flying missiles had been launched at them by India and retaliate, conceivably even with nuclear weapons. We decided to send the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joe Ralston, to have dinner with the top Pakistani military commander at the time the attacks were scheduled. Ralston would tell him what was happening a few minutes before our missiles invaded Pakistani airspace, too late to alert the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, but in time to avoid having them shot down or sparking a counterattack on India. My team was worried about one other thing: my testimony before the grand jury in 3 days on August 17th. They were afraid that it would make me reluctant to strike, or that if I did order the attack, I would be accused of doing it to divert public attention from my problems, especially if the attack didn't get bin Laden. I told them in no uncertain terms that their job was to give me advice on national security. If the recommendation was to strike on the 20th, then that's what we would do. I said I would handle my personal problems. Time was running out on that, too. Chapter 49. On Saturday morning, August 15th, with the grand jury testimony looming and after a miserable sleepless night, I woke up Hillary and told her the truth about what had happened between me and Monica Lewinsky. She looked at me as if I had punched her in the gut. almost as angry at me for lying to her in January as for what I had done. All I could do was tell her that I was sorry, and that I had felt I couldn't tell anyone, even her, what had happened. I told her that I loved her and I didn't want to hurt her or Chelsea, that I was ashamed of what I had done, and that I had kept everything to myself in an effort to avoid hurting my family and undermining the presidency. After all the lies and abuse we had endured from the start of my presidency, I didn't want to be run out of office in the flood tide that followed my deposition in January. I still didn't fully understand why I had done something so wrong and stupid. That understanding would come slowly, in the months of working on our relationship that lay ahead. I had to talk to Chelsea, too. In some ways, that was even harder. Sooner or later, every child learns that her parents aren't perfect, but this went far beyond the normal. I had always believed that I had been a good father. Chelsea's high school years and her freshman year in college had already been clouded by 4 years of intensely personal attacks on her parents. Now Chelsea had to learn that her father not only had done something terribly wrong, but had not told her or her mother the truth about it. I was afraid that I would lose not only my marriage, but my daughter's love and respect as well. The rest of that awful day was dominated by another terrorist attack. In Oman, Northern Ireland, a breakaway faction of the IRA that did not support the Good Friday Accord murdered 28 people in a crowded shopping section of the city with a car bomb. All the parties to the peace process, including Sinn Féin, denounced the bombing. I issued a statement condemning the butchery, extending my sympathy to the victims' families, and urging the parties of peace to redouble their efforts. The outlaw group, which called itself the Real IRA, had about 200 members and supporters, enough to cause real trouble, but not enough to disrupt the peace process. The Omagh bombing showed the utter insanity of going back to the old ways. On Monday, after spending what time I could preparing, I went downstairs to the map room for 4 hours of testimony. Starr had agreed not to bring me down to the courthouse, probably because of the adverse reaction he got when he made Hillary do it. However, he insisted on videotaping my testimony, allegedly because one of the 24 grand jurors couldn't attend the session. David Kendall said the grand jury was welcome to come to the White House if Starr would not videotape my secret testimony. He refused. I suspected that he wanted to send the videotape to Congress, where it could be released without getting him into more hot water. The grand jury was watching the proceedings on closed-circuit television back at the courthouse, while Starr and his interrogators did their best to turn the video into a pornographic home movie, asking me questions designed to humiliate me and to so disgust the Congress and the American people that they would demand my resignation, after which he might be able to indict me. Samuel Johnson once said that nothing concentrates the mind as much as the prospect of one's own destruction. Moreover, I believe that a lot more was at stake than what might happen to me. After the preliminaries, I asked to make a brief statement. I admitted that on certain occasions in 1996 and once in 1997, I engaged in wrongful conduct that included inappropriate intimate contact with Monica Lewinsky, that the conduct, while morally wrong, did not constitute sexual relations as I understood the definition of the term that Judge Wright accepted at the request of the Jones lawyers, that I took full responsibility for my actions, and that I would answer to the best of my ability all the OIC's questions relating to the legality of my actions, but would not say more about the specifics of what had happened. The principal OIC interrogator then took me through a long list of questions dealing with the definition of sexual relations that Judge Wright had imposed. I acknowledged that I had not been trying to be helpful to the Jones lawyers because they, like the OIC, had engaged in repeated unlawful leaks, and since they knew by then that their case had no merit, I believe that their objective in the deposition was to elicit damaging new information from me for the purpose of leaking it. I said that, of course, that I didn't know that by the time I testified, Starr's office had already become heavily involved. Now Starr's lawyers were trying to capitalize on the setup by getting me on videotape discussing things in graphic detail that no one should ever have to talk about publicly. When the OIC lawyer continued to complain about my deposition answers on the sex questions, I reminded him that both my lawyer and I had invited Jones's attorneys to ask specific follow-up questions and that they declined to do so. I said it was now clear to me that they didn't do so because they were no longer trying to get a damaging admission that they could leak to the press. Instead, they were working for Starr. They wanted the deposition to lay the basis for forcing my resignation or impeachment, or perhaps even an indictment. So they didn't ask follow-up questions because they were afraid I would give them a truthful answer. They were trying to set me up and trick me. And now you seem to be complaining that they didn't do a good enough job. I confessed that I deplored what the Rutherford Institute lawyers had done in Jones's name. The tormenting of innocent people, the illegal leaking, the pursuit of a bogus, politically motivated suit. But I was determined to walk through the minefield of this deposition without violating the law, and I believe I did. I did acknowledge that I had misled everyone who asked about the story after it broke, and I said over and over again that I never ask anyone to lie. When the agreed-upon 4 hours had expired, I had been asked many questions 6 or 7 times as the lawyers tried hard to turn my interrogation into admissions that were humiliating and incriminating. That's what the to-date, whole 4-year, $40 million investigation had come down to, parsing the definition of sex. I finished the testimony about 6:30, 3.5 hours before I was scheduled to address the nation. I was visibly upset when I went up to the solarium to see friends and staff who had gathered to discuss what had just happened, including White House counsel Chuck Ruff, David Kendall, Mickey Cantor, Rahm Emanuel, James Carville, Paul Begala, and Harry and Linda Thomason. Chelsea was there too, and to my relief, at about 8, Hillary joined in. We had a discussion about what I should say. Everyone knew I had to admit that I had made an awful mistake and had tried to hide it. The question was whether I should also take a shot at Starr's investigation and say it was time to end it. The virtually unanimous opinion was that I should not. Most people already knew that Starr was out of control. They needed to hear my admission of wrongdoing and witness my remorse. Some of my friends had given what they thought was strategic advice. Others were genuinely appalled by what I had done. Only Hillary refused to express an opinion, instead encouraging everyone to leave me alone to write my statement. At 10 o'clock, I told the American people about my testimony, said I was solely and completely responsible for my personal failure, and admitted misleading everyone, even my wife. I said I was trying to protect myself and my family from intrusive questions in a politically inspired lawsuit that had been dismissed. I also said that Starr's investigation had gone on too long, cost too much, and hurt too many people, and that 2 years earlier, another investigation, a truly independent one, had found no wrongdoing by Hillary or me in Whitewater. Finally, I committed to doing my best to repair my family life, and I hoped we could repair the fabric of our nation's life by stopping the pursuit of personal destruction and prying into private lives and moving on. I believed every word I said, but my anger hadn't worn off enough for me to be as contrite as I should have been. The next day we left for Martha's Vineyard on our annual vacation. Usually I counted the days until we could get away for some family time. This year, though I knew we needed it, I wished I was working around the clock instead. As we walked out to the south lawn to get on the helicopter, with Chelsea between Hillary and me and Buddy walking beside me, photographers took pictures that revealed the pain I had caused. When there were no cameras around, my wife and daughter were barely speaking to me. I spent the first couple of days alternating between begging for forgiveness and planning the strikes on Al-Qaeda. At night, Hillary would go up to bed, and I slept on the couch. On my birthday, General Don Carrick, Sandy Berger's staffer, flew to Martha's Vineyard to go over the targets recommended by the CIA and the Joint Chiefs: the Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and two targets in Sudan, a tannery in which bin Laden had a financial interest, and a chemical plant the CIA believed was being used to produce or store a chemical used in the production of VX nerve gas. I took the tannery off the list because it had no military value to Al-Qaeda, and I wanted to minimize civilian casualties. The hit on the camps would be timed to coincide with the meeting the intelligence indicated bin Laden and his top people would be having. At 3 a.m., I gave Sandy Berger the final order to proceed, and U.S. Navy destroyers in the Northern Arabian Sea launched cruise missiles at the targets in Afghanistan, while missiles were fired at the Sudanese chemical plant from ships in the Red Sea. Most of the missiles hit the targets, but bin Laden was not in the camp where the CIA thought he would be when the missiles hit it. Some reports said he had left the camp only a couple of hours earlier, but we never knew for sure. Several people associated with Al-Qaeda were killed, as were some Pakistani officers who were reported to be there to train Kashmiri terrorists. The Sudanese chemical plant was destroyed. After announcing the attacks in Martha's Vineyard, I flew back to Washington to speak to the American people for the second time in 4 days, telling them I had ordered the strikes because Al-Qaeda was responsible for the embassy bombings and bin Laden was perhaps the preeminent organizer and financier of international terrorism in the world today, a man who had vowed to wage a terrorist war on America with no distinction between military personnel and civilians. I said that our attacks were not aimed against Islam, but against fanatics and killers, and that we had been fighting against them on several fronts for years and would continue to do so because this will be a long, ongoing struggle. Around the time I spoke of the long struggle, I signed the first of a series of orders to prepare for it by using all the tools available. Executive Order 13099 imposed economic sanctions on bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Later, the sanctions were extended to the Taliban as well. To date, we had not been effective in disrupting the terrorists' financial networks. The executive order invoked the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which we had earlier used successfully against the Cali drug cartel in Colombia. I had also asked General Shelton and Dick Clark to develop some of the options for dropping commando forces in Afghanistan. I thought that if we took out a couple of Al-Qaeda's training operations, it would show them how serious we were, even if we didn't get bin Laden or his top lieutenants. It was clear to me that the senior military didn't want to do this, perhaps because of Somalia, perhaps because they would have to send in the special forces without knowing for certain where bin Laden was or whether we could get our troops back out to safety. At any rate, I continued to keep the option alive. I also signed several Memoranda of Notification, MONs, authorizing the CIA to use lethal force to apprehend bin Laden. The CIA had been authorized to conduct its own snatch operation against bin Laden the previous spring, months before the embassy bombings, but it lacked the paramilitary capability to do the job. Instead, it contracted with members of local Afghan tribes to get bin Laden. When field agents or Afghan tribals were apparently uncertain of whether they had to try to capture bin Laden before they used deadly force, I made it clear that they did not. Within a few months, I had extended the lethal force authorization by expanding the list of targeted bin Laden associates and the circumstances under which they could be attacked. By and large, the response of the congressional leaders of both parties to the missile strikes was positive, in large part because they had been well briefed and Secretary Cohen had assured his fellow Republicans that the attack and its timing were justified. Speaker Gingrich said that the United States did exactly the right thing today. Senator Lott said the attacks were appropriate and just. Tom Daschle, Dick Gephardt, and all the Democrats were supportive. Soon I was heartened by the arrest of Mohammed Rashid, an al-Qaeda operative who was a suspect in the Kenyan embassy bombing. Some people criticized me for hitting the chemical plant, which the Sudanese government insisted had nothing to do with the production or storage of dangerous chemicals. I still believe we did the right thing there. The CIA had soil samples taken at the plant site that contained the chemical used to produce VX. In a subsequent terrorist trial in New York City, one of the witnesses testified that bin Laden had a chemical weapons operation in Khartoum. Despite the plain evidence, some people in the media tried to push the possibility that the action was a real-life version of Wag the Dog, a movie in which a fictional president starts a made-for-TV war to distract public attention from his personal problems. The American people had to absorb the news of the strike and my grand jury testimony at the same time. Newsweek ran an article reporting that the public's reaction to my testimony and television address about it was calm and measured. My job rating was 62%, with 73% supporting the missile strikes. Most people thought I had been dishonest in my personal life, but remained credible on public issues. By contrast, Newsweek said the first reaction of the pundit class was near hysteria. They were hitting me hard. I deserved a whipping, all right, but I was getting it at home where it should have been administered. For now, I just hope that the Democrats wouldn't be pushed by the media pounding into calling for my resignation, and that I would be able to repair the breach I had caused with my family, and with my staff, cabinet, and the people who had believed in me through all the years of constant attacks. After the speech, I went back to the vineyard for 10 days. There was not much thaw on the family front. I made my first public appearance since my grand jury testimony, traveling to Worcester, Massachusetts, at the invitation of Congressman Jim McGovern, to promote the Police Corps, an innovative program that provided college scholarships to people who committed to becoming law enforcement officers. Worcester is an old-fashioned blue-collar city. I was somewhat apprehensive about the kind of reception I would get there, and was encouraged to find a large, enthusiastic crowd at an event attended by the mayor, both senators, and 4 Massachusetts congressmen. Many people in the crowd urged me to keep doing my job. Several said they had made mistakes in their lives, too, and were sorry that mine had been aired in public. On August 28th, the 35th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech, I went to a commemorative service at Union Chapel in Oak Bluffs, which had been a vacation mecca for African Americans for more than a century. I shared the platform with Congressman John Lewis, who had worked with Dr. King and was one of the most powerful moral forces in American politics. He and I had been friends for a long time, going back well before 1992. He was one of my earliest supporters and had every right to condemn me. Instead, when he rose to speak, John said that I was his friend and brother, that he had stood with me when I was up and would not leave me when I was down, that I had been a good president, and that if it were up to him, I would continue to be. John Lewis will never know how much he lifted my spirits that day. We returned to Washington at the end of the month to face another tremendous problem. The Asian financial crisis had spread and was now threatening to destabilize the entire global economy. The crisis had begun in Thailand in 1997, then infected Indonesia and South Korea, and now it had spread to Russia. In mid-August, Russia had defaulted on its foreign debt, and by the end of the month, the Russian collapse had caused large drops in stock markets across the world. On August 31st, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 512 points, following a drop of 357 just 4 days earlier. All the gains of 1998 were wiped out. Bob Rubin and his international economics team had been working on the financial crisis since Thailand's trouble began. Although the details of each nation's problem were somewhat different, there were some common elements: flawed banking systems, bad loans, crony capitalism, and a general loss of confidence. The situation was aggravated by the lack of economic growth in Japan over the past 5 years. With no inflation and a 20% savings rate, the Japanese could stand it. But the absence of growth in Asia's largest economy increased the adverse consequences of bad policies elsewhere. Even the Japanese were getting restless. The stagnant economy had contributed to the election losses that had led to the recent resignation of my friend Ryutaro Hashimoto as prime minister. China, with the region's fastest-growing economy, had kept the crisis from growing even worse by refusing to devalue its currency. The general formula for recovery in the 1990s was the extension of sizable loans from the International Monetary Fund and wealthy countries in return for necessary reforms in the affected nations. The reforms were invariably politically difficult. They always forced change on entrenched interests and often required fiscal austerity that made things harder on ordinary citizens in the short run, though it brought a quicker recovery and more stability in the long run. The United States had supported the IMF efforts in Thailand, Indonesia, and South Korea, and had made contributions in the last two cases. The Treasury Department decided not to put money into Thailand because the $17 billion already available was sufficient and because the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which we had used to help Mexico, had some new, albeit temporary, restrictions imposed on it by Congress. The restrictions had expired by the time the other nations needed help, but I regretted not making at least a modest contribution to the Thai package. State, defense, and the NSC all wanted to do it because Thailand was our oldest ally in Southeast Asia. So did I, but we let Treasury make the call. On the economics and in terms of domestic politics, it was the correct decision, but it sent the wrong message to Thais and across Asia. Bob Rubin and I didn't make too many policy errors. I believe this was one of them. We certainly didn't have the Thai problem with Russia. The United States had been supporting the Russian economy since my first year in office, and we had contributed almost a third of the $23 billion IMF package in July. Unfortunately, the first disbursement of about $5 billion from the package had virtually disappeared overnight, as the ruble was devalued and Russians began to move large sums of their own money out of the country. Russia's problems were aggravated by the irresponsible inflationary policies of its central bank and by the Duma's refusal to establish an effective system to collect taxes. The tax rates were high enough, maybe too high, but most taxpayers didn't pay them. Right after we got back from Martha's Vineyard, Hillary and I took a quick trip to Russia and Northern Ireland with Madeleine Albright, Bill Daley, Bill Richardson, and a bipartisan congressional delegation. Ambassador Jim Collins invited a group of leaders of the Duma to his residence, Spaso House. I tried hard to convince them that no nation could escape the discipline of the global economy, and that if they wanted foreign loans and investment, Russia would have to collect taxes, stop printing money to pay bills and bail out troubled banks, avoid crony capitalism, and pay debts. I don't think I made many converts. My 15th meeting with Boris Yeltsin went as well as it could, given his problems. The communists and ultranationalists were blocking his reform proposals in the Duma. He had tried to create a more effective tax collection system by executive action, but he still couldn't stop the central bank from printing too much money, which only encouraged greater capital flight from the ruble to more stable currencies and discouraged foreign credit and investment. For now, all I could do was encourage him and say the rest of the IMF money would be available as soon as it could make a difference. If we released it now, the funds would disappear as quickly as the first installment had. We did make one positive announcement. saying that we would remove from each of our nuclear programs about 50 tons of plutonium, enough to make thousands of bombs, and render the material incapable of being used to make weapons in the future. With terrorist groups as well as hostile nations trying to get their hands on fissile material, it was an important step that could save countless lives. After a speech to the new Northern Ireland Assembly in Belfast, in which I encouraged the members to continue to implement the Good Friday Accord, Hillary and I went with Tony and Cherie Blair, George Mitchell, and Mo Molan, the UK Secretary of State from Northern Ireland, to OMA to meet with victims of the bombing. Tony and I spoke as best we could, then we all moved among the families, listening to their stories, seeing the children who had been scarred, and being struck by the victim's steady determination to stay on the path of peace. During the Troubles, someone had painted a provocative question on a Belfast wall. Is there life before death? Amidst the cruel carnage of OMA, the Irish were still saying yes. Before leaving for Dublin, we and the Blairs attended a gathering for peace in Armagh, the base from which St. Patrick brought Christianity to Ireland, and now the spiritual center in Northern Ireland for both Catholics and Protestants. I was introduced by a lovely 17-year-old girl, Sharon Hawhey, who had written to me when she was just 14, asking me to help end the fighting with a simple solution. Both sides have been hurt. Both sides will have to forgive. In Dublin, Bertie Ahern and I spoke with the press after our meeting. An Irish reporter said, "It usually seems to take a visit from you to give the peace process a boost. Will we need to see you again?" I replied that for their sake, I hoped not, but for my sake, I hoped so. Then Bertie said my quick response to the OMA tragedy had galvanized the parties to make decisions quickly that might have taken weeks and months. Just 2 days earlier, Martin McGuinness, the chief Sinn Féin negotiator, had announced that he would oversee the arms decommissioning process for Sinn Féin. Martin was Gerry Adams's top aide and a powerful force in his own right. The announcement sent a signal to David Trimble and the Unionists that for Sinn Féin and the IRA, violence, as Adams had said, is a thing of the past, over, done with, and gone. In our private meeting, Bertie Ahern told me that after OMA, the IRA had warned the real IRA that if they ever did anything like that again, the British police would be the least of their worries. The first question I got from an American reporter was a request to reply to the stinging rebuke I had received the day before on the floor of the Senate from my longtime friend, Joe Lieberman. I replied, "I agree with what he said. I made a bad mistake, it was indefensible, and I'm sorry about it." Some of our staff were upset that Joe attacked me while I was overseas, but I wasn't. I knew he was a devoutly religious man who was angry about what I had done, and he had carefully avoided saying that I should be impeached. Our last stop in Ireland was in Limerick, where 50,000 supporters of peace filled the streets, including the relatives of one member of our delegation, Congressman Peter King of New York, who had brought his mother home for the event. I told the crowd that my friend Frank McCourt had memorialized the old Limerick in Angela's ashes, but I like the new one better. On September 9th, Ken Starr sent his 445-page report to Congress, alleging 11 impeachable offenses. Even with all the crimes of Watergate, Leon Jaworski hadn't done that. The independent counsel was supposed to report his findings to Congress if he found substantial and credible evidence to support an impeachment. Congress was supposed to decide if there were grounds for impeachment. The report was made public on the 11th. Jaworski's never was. In Starr's report, the word sex appeared more than 500 times. Whitewater was mentioned twice. He and his allies thought that they could wash away all their sins over the last 4 years in my dirty laundry. On September 10th, I called the cabinet to the White House and apologized to them. Many of them didn't know what to say. They believed in what we were doing. and appreciated the opportunity I had given them to serve. But most of them felt I had been selfish and stupid and had left them hanging for 8 months. Madeline Albright led off, saying that I had done wrong and she was disappointed, but our only option was to go back to work. Donna Shalala was tougher, saying it was important for leaders to be good people as well as to have good policies. My longtime friends James Lee Witt and Rodney Slater talked about the power of redemption and quoted scripture. Bruce Babbitt, a Catholic, talked about the power of confession. Carol Browner says she had been forced to talk with her son about subjects she had never thought she'd have to discuss with him. Listening to my cabinet, I really understood for the first time the extent to which the exposure of my misconduct and my dishonesty about it had opened a Pandora's box of emotions in the American people. It was easy enough to say that I had been through a lot in the past 6 years, and that Starr's Inquisition had been awful, and the Jones lawsuit was bogus and politically motivated. Easy enough to say that even a president's personal life should remain private. But once what I had done was out there in all its stark ugliness, people's evaluations of it were inevitably a reflection of their own personal experiences, marked not only by their convictions, but also by their own fears, disappointments, and heartbreak. My cabinet's honest and very different reactions gave me a direct sense of what was going on in conversations all across America. As the impeachment hearings grew closer, I received many letters from friends and strangers alike. Some of the letter writers offered touching words of support and encouragement. Some told their own stories of failure and recovery. Some expressed outrage over the actions of Starr. Some were full of condemnation and disappointment over what I had done. And still others reflected a combination of all these views. Reading the letters helped me to deal with my own emotions and to remember that if I wanted to be forgiven, I had to forgive. The atmosphere in the yellow oval room remained awkward and tense until Bob Rubin spoke. Rubin was the one person in the room who best understood what my life had been like for the last 4 years. He had been through an exhaustive investigation of Goldman Sachs that featured one of his partners being hauled away in handcuffs before he was cleared. After several others had spoken, Rubin said with characteristic bluntness, "There's no question you screwed up, but we all make mistakes, even big ones. In my opinion, the bigger issue is the disproportion of the media coverage and the hypocrisy of some of your critics." The atmosphere got better after that. I'm grateful that no one quit. We all went back to work. On September 15th, I hired Greg Craig, a fine lawyer and old friend of Hillary's and mine from law school, to work with Chuck Ruff, David Kendall, Bruce Lindsay, Cheryl Mills, Lanny Brewer, and Nicole Seligman on my defense team. On the 18th, just as I knew they would, the House Judiciary Committee voted on a straight party line vote to release the video of my grand jury testimony to the public. A few days later, Hillary and I hosted our annual breakfast for religious leaders at the White House. We usually discussed shared public concerns. This time, I asked for their prayers during my personal travail. I have been on quite a journey these last few weeks to get to the end of this, to the rock-bottom truth of where I am and where we all are. I agree with those who have said that in my first statement after I testified, I was not contrite enough. I don't think there is a fancy way to say that I have sinned. I said that I was sorry for all who had been hurt, my family, friends, staff, cabinet, and Monica Lewinsky and her family, that I had asked for their forgiveness, and that I would pursue counseling from pastors and others to find, with God's help, a willingness to give the very forgiveness I seek. A renunciation of the pride and the anger which cloud judgment, lead people to excuse and compare and to blame and complain. I also said I would mount a vigorous defense in response to the charges against me and would intensify my efforts to do my job, in the hope that with a broken spirit and a still strong heart, I can be used for greater good. I had asked three pastors to counsel me at least once a month for an indefinite period. Phil Wagaman, our minister at Foundry Methodist Church, my friend Tony Campolo, and Gordon MacDonald, a minister and author of several books I had read on living one's faith. They would more than fulfill their commitment, usually coming to the White House together, sometimes separately. We would pray, read scripture, and discuss some things I had never really talked about before. The Reverend Bill Hybels from Chicago also continued to come to the White House regularly to ask searching questions designed to check my spiritual health. Even though they were often tough on me, the pastors took me past the politics into soul searching and the power of God's love. Hillary and I also began a serious counseling program, one day a week for about a year. For the first time in my life, I actually talked openly about feelings, experiences, and opinions about life, love, and the nature of relationships. I didn't like everything I learned about myself or my past, and it pained me to face the fact that my childhood and the life I'd led since growing up had made some things difficult for me that seemed to come more naturally to other people. I also came to understand that when I was exhausted, angry, or feeling isolated and alone, I was more vulnerable to making selfish and self-destructive personal mistakes about which I would later be ashamed. The current controversy was the latest casualty of my lifelong effort to lead parallel lives, to wall off my anger and grief and get on with my outer life, which I loved and lived well. During the government shutdowns, I was engaged in two titanic struggles, a public one with Congress over the future of our country, and a private one to hold the old demons at bay. I had won the public fight and lost the private one. In so doing, I had hurt more than my family and my administration. It was also damaging to the presidency and the American people. No matter how much pressure I was under, I should have been stronger and behaved better. There was no excuse for what I did. But trying to come to grips with why I did it gave me at least a chance to finally unify my parallel lives. In the long counseling sessions and our conversations about them afterward, Hillary and I also got to know each other again, beyond the work and ideas we shared and the child we adored. I had always loved her very much, but not always very well. I was grateful that she was brave enough to participate in the counseling. We were still each other's best friend, and I hoped we could save our marriage. Meanwhile, I was still sleeping on a couch, this one in the small living room that adjoined our bedroom. I slept on that old couch for 2 months or more. I got a lot of reading, thinking, and work done, and the couch was pretty comfortable. But I hoped I wouldn't be on it forever. As the Republicans intensified their criticism of me, my supporters started to stand up. On September 11th, 800 Irish Americans gathered on the South Lawn as Brian O'Dwyer presented me with an award named after his late father, Paul, for my role in the Irish peace process. Brian's remarks and the crowd's response to them left no doubt about why they were really there. A few days later, Václav Havel came to Washington for a state visit, telling the press I was his great friend. As the press continued to ask questions about impeachment, resignation, and whether I had lost my moral authority to lead, Havel said America had many different faces. I love most of these faces. There are some I don't understand. I don't like to speak about things which I don't understand. 5 days after that, I went to New York for the opening session of the UN General Assembly to deliver a speech on the world's shared obligation to fight terrorists, to give them no support, sanctuary, or financial assistance, to bring pressure on states that do, to step up extradition and prosecutions, to sign the global anti-terror conventions and strengthen and enforce the ones designed to protect us against biological and chemical weapons, to control the manufacture and export of explosives, to raise international standards for airport security, and to combat the conditions that breed terror. It was an important speech, especially at that time, but the delegates in the cavernous hall of the General Assembly were also thinking about events in Washington. When I stood up to speak, they responded with an enthusiastic and prolonged standing ovation. It was unheard of for the normally reserved UN, and I was profoundly moved. I wasn't sure whether the unprecedented act was more of a gesture of support for me or opposition to what was going on in Congress. While I was speaking to the UN about terrorism, all the television networks were showing the videotape of my grand jury testimony. The next day at the White House, I held a reception for Nelson Mandela with African-American religious leaders. It was his idea. The Congress had voted to give him the Congressional Gold Medal, and he was to receive it the following day. Mandela called to say he suspected the timing of the award was no accident. As the President of South Africa, I cannot decline this award, but I would like to come a day early and tell the American people what I think about what the Congress is doing to you. And that's exactly what he did, saying that he had never seen a reception at the UN like the one I had received, that the world needed me, and that my adversaries should leave me alone. The pastors applauded their approval. As good as Mandela was, the Reverend Bernice King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, stole the show. She said that even great leaders sometimes commit grievous sins, that King David had done something far worse than I had in arranging the death in battle of Bathsheba's husband, who was David's loyal soldier, so that David could marry her, and that David had to atone for his sin and was punished for it. No one could tell where Bernice was going until she got to the closing. Yes, David committed a terrible sin and God punished him, but David remained king. Meanwhile, I kept working, pushing my proposal for school modernization and construction funds in Maryland, Florida, and Illinois, talking to the National Farmers Union about agriculture, giving an important address on modernizing the global financial system at the Council on Foreign Relations, meeting with the Joint Chiefs on the readiness of our armed forces, drumming up support for another minimum wage increase at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union, receiving the final report on the President's Advisory Commission on Race from John Hope Franklin, holding a dialogue with Tony Blair, Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, and President Peter Stoyanov of Bulgaria on the applicability to other nations of the third way philosophy Tony and I had embraced, having my first meeting with the new Japanese Prime Minister, Keizo Obuchi, bringing Netanyahu and Arafat to the White House in an attempt to get the peace process going, and appearing at more than a dozen campaign events for Democrats in six states and Washington, D.C. On September 30th, the last day of the fiscal year, I announced that we had run a budget surplus of about $70 billion, the first one in 29 years. Although the press was focused on little besides the Star Report, there were, as always, a lot of other things going on, and they had to be dealt with. I was determined not to let the public's business grind to a halt, and was gratified that the White House staff and cabinet felt the same way. No matter what was in the daily news, they kept doing their job. In October, the House Republicans, led by Henry Hyde and his colleagues on the Judiciary Committee, continued to push for my impeachment. The committee Democrats, led by John Conyers of Michigan, fought them tooth and nail, arguing that even if the worst charges against me were true, they didn't amount to the high crimes and misdemeanors the Constitution required for impeachment. The Democrats were right on the law, but the Republicans had the votes. On October 8th, the House voted to open an inquiry into whether I should be impeached. I wasn't surprised. We were just a month away from the midterm elections, and the Republicans were running a single-issue campaign: Get Clinton. After the election, I believed the moderate Republicans would look at the facts and the law and decide against impeachment in favor of a resolution of censure or reprimand, which is what Newt Gingrich had received for false statements and apparent violations of the tax laws. Many of the pundits were predicting disaster for the Democrats. The conventional wisdom was that we would lose 25 to 35 seats in the House and 4 to 6 seats in the Senate because of the controversy. It seemed a safe bet to most people in Washington. The Republicans had $100 million more than the Democrats to spend, and more Democrats than Republicans were up for re-election in the Senate. Among the contested Senate seats, the Democrats seemed sure to pick up the one in Indiana, where the candidate was Governor Evan Bayh, while Ohio Governor George Voinovich seemed certain to win the seat being vacated by John Glenn for the Republicans. That left 7 seats up in the air, 5 currently held by Democrats and only 2 by Republicans. I disagreed with the conventional wisdom for several reasons. First, a majority of Americans disapproved of the way Starr was conducting himself and resented the fact that the Republican Congress was more interested in hurting me than in helping them. Almost 80% disapproved of the release of my grand jury videotape, and overall approval of the Congress had dropped to 43%. Second, as Gingrich had shown with the contract with America in 1994, if the public believed one party had a positive agenda and the other didn't, the party with the plan would win. The Democrats were united with a midterm program for the first time ever. Save Social Security first, before spending the surplus on new programs or tax cuts. Put 100,000 teachers in our schools. Modernize old schools and build new ones. Raise the minimum wage. And pass the Patients' Bill of Rights. Finally, a sizable majority of Americans were opposed to impeachment. If Democrats ran on their plan and against impeachment, I thought they might actually be able to win the House. I did some political events at the beginning and end of October, most of them near Washington in settings designed to emphasize the issues our candidates were stressing. Otherwise, I spent most of the month on the job. There was plenty of work to do, by far the most important of which involved the Middle East. Madeleine Albright and Dennis Ross had been laboring for months to get the peace process back on track, and Madeleine had finally gotten Arafat and Netanyahu together when they were in New York for the UN General Assembly session. Neither of them was ready to take the next steps or to be seen by his own constituents as compromising too much, but both were concerned that the deteriorating situation could easily get out of hand, especially if Hamas launched a new round of attacks. The next day, the leaders came down to Washington to see me, and I announced plans to bring them back to the United States within a month to hammer out an agreement. In the interim, Madeleine went to the region to see them. They met on the border between Israel and Gaza, then Arafat took them to his guest house for lunch, making the hardliner Netanyahu the first Israeli prime minister to go into Palestinian Gaza. Months of work had gone into preparation of the summit. Both parties wanted the United States to work with them on the hard decisions and believed that the high drama of the event would help them sell those decisions back home. Of course, in any summit, there's always a risk that the two sides won't be able to reach an agreement and that the high-profile effort will damage all involved. My national security team was worried about the possibility of failure and its consequences. Both Arafat and Netanyahu had staked out tough positions in public, and Bibi had bolstered his rhetoric by naming Ariel Sharon the most hard-line of the prominent Likud leaders foreign minister. Sharon had referred to the 1993 peace agreement as national suicide for Israel. It was impossible to know whether Netanyahu had given Sharon the portfolio to have someone to blame if the summit failed, or to provide himself cover on the right if it succeeded. I thought the summit was a good idea and was eager to hold it. It seemed to me that we didn't have much to lose, and I always preferred failure in a worthy effort to inaction for fear of failure. On the 15th, we kicked things off at the White House. Then the delegations moved to the Y River Conference Center in Maryland. It was well suited to the task at hand. The public meeting and dining spaces were comfortable, and the living quarters were laid out in such a way that the delegations could have all their people staying together and at a fair distance from the other side. Originally, we had planned for the summit to last for 4 days. It would end 2 days before Netanyahu had to be back in Israel to open the new session of the Knesset. We agreed on the usual rules. Neither side was bound by interim agreements on specific issues until a complete accord was reached, and the United States would draft the final agreement. I told them I would be there as much as I could, but would helicopter back to the White House at night, no matter how late, so that I could work in the office the next morning to sign legislation and continue negotiating with Congress on the budget bills. We were in the new fiscal year, but less than a third of the 13 appropriations bills had been passed and signed into law. The Marines who ran HMX-1, the presidential helicopter, did a great job for me over 8 years, but during Y River they were even more invaluable, staying on duty to fly me back to the White House at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning after the late sessions. At the first dinner, I urged Arafat and Netanyahu to think about how they could help each other cope with their domestic opposition. They thought and talked for 4 days, but were exhausted from trying and were nowhere near an agreement. Netanyahu told me we couldn't reach agreement on all the issues and suggested a partial one. Israel would withdraw from 13% of the West Bank, and the Palestinians would dramatically improve cooperation on security, following a plan developed with the help of CIA Director George Tenet, who enjoyed the confidence of both sides. Late that night, I met alone with Ariel Sharon for the first time. The 70-year-old former general had been part of Israel's creation and all its subsequent wars. He was unpopular among Arabs not only for his hostility to trading land for peace, but also for his role in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, in which a large number of unarmed Palestinian refugees were killed by the Lebanese militia that was allied with Israel. During our meeting, which ran more than 2 hours, I mostly asked questions and listened. Sharon was not without sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians. He wanted to help them economically, but did not believe giving up the West Bank was in Israel's security interest, nor did he trust Arafat to fight terror. He was the only member of the Israeli delegation who would not shake hands with Arafat. I enjoyed hearing Sharon talk about his life and his views, and when we finished at nearly 3 in the morning, I had a better understanding of how he thought. One thing that surprised me was how hard he pushed me to pardon Jonathan Pollard, a former U.S. Navy intelligence analyst who had been convicted in 1986 of spying for Israel. Rabin and Netanyahu had previously asked for Pollard's release, too. It was obvious that this was an issue in Israeli domestic politics and that the Israeli public didn't think the United States should have punished Pollard so severely since it was to an ally that he had sold highly sensitive information. The case would come up again before we finished. Meanwhile, I continued to work with the leaders and to talk with their team members, including the Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Mordecai, Arafat's senior advisors Abu Allah and Abu Mazen, both of whom would later become Palestinian prime ministers, Saeb Erekat, Arafat's chief negotiator, and Mohammed Dahlan, the 37-year-old security chief in Gaza. Both the Israelis and the Palestinians were diverse, impressive groups. I tried to spend time with all of them. There was no telling who might make a decisive case for peace when we were alone in their separate delegations. When we hadn't reached consensus by Sunday night, the parties agreed to extend the talks, and Al Gore joined me to add his powers of persuasion to our team, which included Sandy Berger, Rob Malley, and Bruce Rydell from the White House, and Secretary Albright, Dennis Ross, Martin Indyk, Aaron Miller, Wendy Sherman, and Tony Verstandig from the State Department. Every day they would take turns working on the Israeli and Palestinian counterparts on various issues, always looking for that streak of light that might break through the clouds. The State Department translator Gamal Halal also played a unique role in these and other negotiations. The members of both delegations spoke English, but Arafat always conducted business in Arabic. Gamal was usually the only other person in the room during my one-on-one meetings with Arafat. He understood the Middle East and the role each member of the Palestinian delegation played in their deliberations, and Arafat liked him. He would become an advisor on my team. On more than one occasion, his insight and his personal connection with Arafat would prove invaluable. On Monday, I felt we were making headway again. I kept pushing Netanyahu to give Arafat the benefits of peace, the land, the airport, the safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank, a port in Gaza, so that he would be strong enough to fight terror. And I pressed Arafat not only to increase his efforts on security, but to call the Palestinian National Council together to formally revise the Palestinian Covenant, excising the language calling for the destruction of Israel. The PLO Executive Council had already renounced the provisions, but Netanyahu thought Israeli citizens would never believe they had a partner for peace until the elected Palestinian Assembly voted to delete the offensive language from the charter. Arafat didn't want to call the council into session because he thought he might not be able to control the outcome. Palestinians the world over were eligible to vote for council members, and many of the expatriates were not as supportive of the compromises inherent in the peace process and of his leadership as were the Palestinians living in Gaza and the West Bank. On the 20th, King Hussein and Queen Noor joined us. Hussein was in the United States for cancer treatments at the Mayo Clinic. I had kept him briefed on our progress and problems. Although he was weakened by his illness and the chemotherapy treatments, he said he would come to Y if I thought it would help. After talking to Noor, who assured me that he wanted to come and that he would be fine in whatever guest quarters were available, I told Hussein we could use all the help we could get. It is difficult to describe or overstate the impact Hussein's presence had on the talks. He had lost a lot of weight, and the chemotherapy had taken all of his hair, even his eyebrows, but his mind and heart were still strong. He was very helpful, talking common sense to both sides, and the very sight of him diminished the posturing and pettiness that are a usual part of all such negotiations. On the 21st, we had reached agreement only on the security issue, and it looked as if Netanyahu might celebrate his 49th birthday by leaving the failed talks. The next day, I came back to stay for the duration. After the two sides met alone for 2 hours, they came up with an ingenious way to get the Palestinian Council to vote on changing the charter. I would go to Gaza to address the group with Arafat, who would then ask for a show of support by raised hands or clapping or stamping of feet. Sandy Berger, although he was supportive of the plan, warned that it was a risky move for me. That was true, but we were asking the Israelis and Palestinians to take bigger risks. I agreed to do it. That night we were still hung up on Arafat's demand for the release of 1,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. Netanyahu said he couldn't release Hamas members or others with blood on their hands, and he thought no more than 500 could be let go. I knew we were at a breaking point, and had asked Hussein to come to the large cabin where we were dining to talk to both delegations together. When he entered the room, his regal aura, luminous eyes, and simple eloquence seemed magnified by his physical decline. In his deep, sonorous voice, he said that history would judge us all, that the differences remaining between the parties were trivial compared with the benefits of peace, and that they had to achieve it for the sake of their children. His unspoken message was equally clear. I may not have long to live. It's up to you not to let the peace die. After Hussein left, we kept going, with everyone staying in the dining room and collecting around different tables to keep working on various issues. I told my team we were out of time and I wasn't going to bed.
End of Disc 15.